Change doesn't wait. Sometimes it storms in, and sometimes it creeps in quietly, unfolding in ways we'll notice later. It stirs in boardrooms, classrooms, streets, and communities, where other people act with purpose. What moves you? A vision? A challenge? A belief that business is a force for good? And what holds you back? External factors, limiting beliefs, or habits? I'm Michelle Knorr.
And I'm Gary Watts, and this is Moved, the podcast of 289 people inspiring change. We'll be speaking with people exploring what first moved them, what they've achieved, and the challenges they've had to overcome, both outside and within. Each episode is about human performance, leadership, sustainability, doing the work that matters, and the moments that change everything. Today, we're joined by Vibhuti Bhatia, founder of South Asians for Sustainability and managing consultant for social sustainability at Energize. Coming from a British Indian heritage, she has always felt passionately about diversity, inclusion, and equitable representation, and these themes course through her work and collaborations. Vibs additionally pursues music as lead chorus in the Orchestral Kuali Project and individual fusion music commissions, expressing both South Asian language and Indian culture alongside her upbringing in the UK. We loved having Vibs as guest 16. Vibs, welcome to the show.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Really good to see you. And the two of you, you know each other from the past, is that right?
Yes. We worked together at EY what feels like many years ago now. It probably was over 3 years ago. But yeah, it's a pleasure to reconnect, and yeah, it's been really lovely.
Yeah, fabulous. When I was chatting with Michelle, she told me all about you. It sounds like a kind of a shared love of sustainability, and it sounded like some of the work at EY related to that. But that would be the first place I'd like to go, really, just understanding when your personal journey into sustainability, what that looked like.
It's really interesting you ask, and I think my answer has changed over time. So when I first started, I thought it was all linked to my day, this cliche penny drop moment at university, where I was studying psychology actually, but I had a few modules out of interest that I uptook in global challenges and social enterprise and a few other optionals. But global challenges was the module where I felt in that moment, I was like, this is the space I really want to work in. Psychology was always a love, and it still is like a really interest of mine. And I love learning about it, but I never knew how it would translate for me in a career personally. So I used to think it was that penny drop moment. But actually, the more I've reflected on my own personal journey, it actually starts, the seed was sown a lot earlier in my life. I grew up in a very spiritual, service-driven community where we, like in South Asian philosophy, it's called seva, or selfless service, in many South Asian-based religions. And part of my community work growing up was linked to tree plantations, clean-up drives, community drives as a whole, like raising money for food banks and so on. And so I think it was actually the seed then that was sown of this integral value of giving back and being of service. But I didn't think at that age in my life, or when I was younger, that it could eventually evolve into an actual career for myself. I didn't really connect the dots. And perhaps back then it was corporate social responsibility, you could say, within like corporate and business environments, and less sustainability. But yeah, I think that's where it really started for me, and then building up through to studying at university, connecting with different charities post-university, working in the Midlands with a few. One that comes to back to me is WASUP. So it was World Against Single-Use Plastics. It was a charity that I was quite involved in heavily. And then moving on to my first kind of sustainable business coordinator role. And that's broadly the journey that got me to now, and yeah, working in the space.
I love it. I love it. So university, looking at global challenges, and you think that's the penny drop moment, but actually, when you really think about it, it goes back a lot deeper. And selfless service.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. So in a lot of, I'm not religious myself, but in Hindu philosophy, Sikh philosophy, main religions of South Asian region, there's this concept of beyond, like us all being connected in a way that's more than physical. You know, it goes back to that soul energetic connection, however you want to phrase it. But this, yeah, this desire to give back in a way that it's not for your own personal gain, and you're doing things in service of others or other things or something greater than yourself. And I think that, yeah, that's something that's very, when I look at my family-based values as well, and the way that I've been raised within my family, that's something that's been really core to us as a whole. And that's something that's my parents have really instilled in me, to always look at the bigger perspective and kind of remain humble. I think that's a kind of a quality that, especially as a South Asian woman, for many reasons can come through over time. But yeah, that fundamentally, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, yeah. I had a wonderful guest on recently, Tama Cowell, and she was talking about the interconnectedness of things, which appeals to me. Actually, it resonates a lot with me for various reasons, the interconnectedness of things. But so we were talking about business and sustainability. And if I can't remember exactly the phrase, but business is dependent on nature. Mm. It's not that you should maybe have sustainability on the side, as it's a nice other thing to do, as well as your actual core business. But business actually literally depends on the natural world, because without it, then it all kind of falls down. It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're less religious, like personally, but it's more kind of the community and that upbringing and like with your parents. Yeah,
definitely. And definitely spiritual. So I fundamentally believe we're all connected and we're beyond this like physical body form. That's just a personal philosophy that I follow. We're all connected through energy. Something that Brian Cox shared in one of, like from a physics perspective, that we're all stars at one point in time and space, something that I really resonate with, and we just change form. Without going too deep, that's kind of philosophically how I see the world and how I feel that interconnectedness. There's also other things like Ubuntu or Vasudev Kutumbakam, which is from, again, Sanskrit philosophy, which means the world is all one family. And I see that in all creation. And I think it, yeah, is fundamentally what stems my passion for sustainability, purpose-driven career, and wanting to
leave it. I love that. I could talk about that with you all day long, I think. Really good. You mentioned psychology as well, so you had an interest in that.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've always gravitated, being quite a people person, understanding what drives people, what motivates them, understanding why people have certain biases or schemas or stereotypes. It's been something that's always kind of fascinated me, and learning more, as especially in like my later teenage years, learning more about history of South Asian communities, looking at colonialism, looking at how migration patterns have impacted my family particularly, but also other South Asian families who've come to the UK or East Africa, or that has always been something that I'm really interested in. And I think that's when I started digging a bit deeper, asking my grandparents questions about their migration journeys. I realized like it goes beyond a lot of the surface level, like just this is what happened, and the what made them the people that they are today and the way that our communities are, it actually stems a lot, it goes more deeply into it. So I think that's where, when I was having those conversations in my later teen years, where the spark started to come for psychology and understanding on a deeper level what motivates and drives people, why certain behaviors come up. And I think, till now, it's always served in whatever job role I've had, having that fundamental understanding of us as humans, and even like neuroscience, like the nerdy part of me, like I love knowing that certain things are just brain chemicals, and you know, it's really fascinates me. But I've been able to apply all of that knowledge in whatever job role I've had, and it's always helped a lot in my deeper understanding, giving people benefit of the doubt and trying to understand what their life experience might have been to have led to a certain engagement or experience, or so I think it relates to everything, and still till day I find it as such a valuable piece of learning through my academic journey as well, to serve in my career.
Well, are there any particular life experiences that either some of your, you know, family had, or that, you know, you had growing up, that you think, yeah, it's that one or two stories that stick with you that, you know?
Yeah, I can share a bit more about it. So it was all about hoarding, actually, because I lived, before I got married, in an intergenerational home, which is relatively rare nowadays in South Asian families even. So growing up for almost, most of my life with my grandparents, my parents, my dad's brother, his wife and kids, we were all in one big home, which was amazing. And I cherished that so, so much. But there were very few members of my family, and a lot of them, like my grandparents, my mother, who was born in India and moved to the UK after getting married, they had these tendencies of like hoarding or holding on to things. And I'd see like the clutter around the house, and that's what started the conversations. So I'd be like, why do we need more stuff? Like, why are we gathering more and more things? A big one in my family was gifts. So they'd be like people coming from India or traveling to India and bringing back loads of stuff with them. And I'm like, for what? And they're like, oh, we're just going to gift it to somebody. But I'm like, there's already like 50 things piled up in the garage. Like, why do we need?
Yeah.
So there was all these kind of like fun, like comedic kind of conversations that led me to realizing, actually, psychologically, so much of that gave them a sense of stability and like holding on to things. I mean, there's been loads of studies on it now, but it is that sense. They went through a period and patch of great instability, particularly my grandfather. You know, he prior to the partition used to live in what is now Pakistan, and he shares stories of, you know, his childhood, where during that, like, they've had a very short period of time, his mother kind of tied him to his back, his brother next to him, had like a sewing machine on one hip, and they're literally walking to cross the border to find safety. So you can see how something like that has been quite traumatizing, but also a sense of stability that comes with things. And maybe they didn't even realize that psychologically that's why he had a hoarding tendency, or my grandmother has it, just because it gives them a greater sense of stability. So not to go too deep into that's just one instance where, you know, you can see how these patterns impact communities who've been through unstable and traumatic experiences in earlier life, it translates to kind of their behaviors today.
Yeah, that's powerful stuff. I never really kind of thought about, maybe the relationship between objects and the stability that kind of might give in a way. And yeah, that would explain the kind of the hoarding thing in a way, wouldn't it? You know, we like to gift, we want to do things like that. But sometimes that is, you know, on one level, you know, plastic made objects and so on. But on another level, you know, it's maybe quite deeply important for that.
And I think just broadly, South Asian culture is huge on gift giving. Particularly, I'm Punjabi, Indian heritage, and in our culture, which actually, I mean, pre-partition, Pakistan, India, it's Punjab, like place. So there's a lot of similarities culturally, and gift giving is a huge part of it. It's like a love language, right? But it's massive for Punjabis, so it makes sense. As a building community and that spirit, it's still very much alive, which, I think there's a beauty to it as well.
Fabulous. So moving forward then, social impact, sustainability, obviously they're quite big, you know, vast areas. And I'd like to touch on your current role as well with Energize. Yeah. But within that whole field now, what are the areas that you're really passionate about?
Really interesting question. And I think it took me time to get to this point, to be honest, in my career. Started off with more broader in consulting at UI, as we mentioned. It was a lot broader than just social. So I've had experience in environmental reporting, risk and opportunities, kind of looking at broader things, but I have always come back to people. And maybe this is also linked to the psychology part of what pulls me in. I can't see how we're going to fix the climate crisis without people. And I think the way it led to this point was earlier on in my first kind of corporate role. I would start attending networking events, as you do, and like seeing, you know, going to conferences, meeting more people, seeking mentorship. And it was really striking to me that there were so few people of colour in the rooms that I was attending, in those events, even speaking. Like, sometimes I'd be the only person of colour in the room, let alone South Asian woman. And it was just startling, because I was like, so much of the climate crisis is impacting communities in the global south. Why are they, their voices and that perspective not represented in these you know, decision making situations, or even just more broadly in the space? And that's when that kind of shift happened, where I was like, we need to be building community driven solutions and hearing from the perspectives of Global South communities. And I think that's how I would now relate when I think of social impact and I think of social sustainability, so to speak. It's all about the human rights aspect. It's all about having those people in those conversations and their representation, and the whole perspective of climate injustice. How that translates to, I guess, your question on my current role, Energize, I do now focus in wholly on social sustainability, whether that's through diversity, equity, inclusion, kind of support services, looking at strategies, right through to human rights assessments in supply chains, and kind of auditing companies on their policies and their processes. And it shows up in more, I guess, business practical terms rather than, so to speak, injustice. But, you know, the back end of all of it is linked to climate injustice and wanting to support communities that, especially in certain sectors like fashion, or, you know, even when you go more broadly looking at manufacturing and all sorts, like making sure that the best possible practices are still there, because we know that for many reasons it's still very not safe for environments, and it is, yeah, they're not getting paid fairly. So there's still a lot of work to do. But yeah, that was kind of my journey and what led me to really the social sustainability side of things, and my passion for tackling injustice really came.
Yeah. And you mentioned, like, you know, one of the things that you'd observed was that, you know, you're sometimes in the room and, yeah, the only person of colour, the only person, you know, female of colour, South Asian, and the underrepresentation of, you know, various communities that are the most impacted. Mm-hmm. What can you give an example of when you would like first see a shift where actually there is better representation? Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
Communities that are being impacted are in the discussion and having a voice, because that seems like quite a leap from what was the norm.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's happened quite an unprecedented rate, which is in a positive way. Now when I look at kind of the speaker list for things like ED and different conferences that happen, you'll be, it is like, it's a lot, so different to when I first look back, like almost even 6-7 years ago, things have really shifted. I think an example, so from day one, I've been, well, on behalf of South Asians for Sustainability, which I'm sure we'll talk about, we've been involved in the race report with students organising for sustainability. And it's the first of its kind where we actually look at the diversity representation and reporting within the environment sector. There were stats that became available back in 2017, I think ONS based, that showed, and I think it's still the case, the environment sector is still the second least diverse after farming in the UK.
I didn't know that.
And so I think that's what spurred on the need for the race report and wanting to get better data and understanding of the general workforce and whether those communities are being represented. In the almost five years that I've now worked with them, we've seen a significant shift and a change. I think that's because more jobs generally have become available in our space. When you compare it to even 10 years ago, there's a lot more opportunity. And that's built in within across sectors, across different job roles. Like if you're in finance, there's been a huge shift in obviously climate finance roles. If you're in HR, the tying up with diversity, equity, inclusion and community impact is now kind of fits under sustainability reporting as well. So I think there's been a lot of structural change that's happened alongside the importance for sustainability at the same time, which has meant that more people can then access those jobs and apply. And I think that's been hand in hand what we've actually seen through the data as well, why more people are of diverse backgrounds now working in the space. But there's still a long way to go. You know, it's not just about hiring those people into those roles, it's about supporting their progress and not letting them stay stunted in kind of those middle management roles. So yeah, that's where we're at. But I can back seeing this shift that's happened, especially in the UK.
Yeah, that's so exciting that there's work to be done, but you're having an impact. So Energize then, when did you start that and where did the idea of it come from? And the name as well.
Energize is, so I'm managing consultant at Energize, and I was lucky enough to join the company 3 years ago. I was brought in to set up the social sustainability team there, which is now, you know, building up really nicely. And we've been able to set some great foundation despite the shifts that we've seen and the knock-on effect in our industry for consultants overall in the past kind of year, not mentioning a certain administration and their part to play in that. I think it's been a really interesting time to be working in consulting and this space. And I'm just grateful that, you know, I have an employer that's really, for the first time in my career, allowed me to do a lot of the things that I do and wear all the hats that I wear without feeling the sense of kind of guilt or not being able to do my best in all the roles I have. I'm also a musician and obviously run South Asians for Sustainability. So there's a lot of things that I do, and being in a space where all of that is championed and I can still do my job, it's the first time I've felt like seen and like a sense of belonging in the truest sense, because I don't have to put on a certain front at work or pretend like I don't care about certain things, you know. And I think that's been really pivotal in me being able to align myself in my career to now. It's great.
Fabulous. I know Michelle in particular wants to explore South Asians for Sustainability with you, but the musician.
Yeah.
What do you play?
Play guitar and I sing in Hindi, English and Punjabi. And kind of throughout my musical journey, I think it's been hand in hand with my identity journey growing up as a child in the UK, but of Indian descent and heritage. It's been an exploration, and I've kind of gone full circle. Again, started off in very spiritual, devotional roots, kind of connecting into what we were talking about earlier with my family values. Yeah. Gone full circle, like explored every genre of music. And now back to those kind of the spiritual devotional music, but with an orchestra, so it feels very fused with my British identity and Indian as well.
I would love to listen to some of that, because I'm actually share some of that interest. Some of the Eastern religions I'm, you know, quite passionate about, actually. I'm very interested in them. And also we talked previously about, you know, South Asian music, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
And things. So yeah, that sounds amazing. We'd love to listen to that at some point. Michelle?
Absolutely. So we've covered the managing consultant side of you, but we haven't like discussed that much about the founder side. And every time I think of VIBS, I think of South Asians for Sustainability. So I wanted to just understand, and so did Gary, actually, like, what is the story behind South Asians for Sustainability? What was the gap that you saw? Just like, tell us everything, please.
Yeah, definitely. I think I briefly mentioned it already, but it was that first point in my first corporate role at Currys. And it wasn't to the company at all. It was the sector and industry as a whole. I was seeking mentorship for myself, really selfishly just trying to be like, okay, what's my next step? But ideally, I wanted it from some advice from someone who could also relate to my cultural heritage and upbringing and the kind of things that drive me to want to work in this space. And I just could not find a single platform at all. Like, I could find individual activists or more broadly kind of people of colour for sustainability type communities, but not specific to South Asian community. And this was at the same time, like, we were in lockdown during COVID. So had an abundant, well, a lot more time, it felt like, on our hands. So I started just linking with people online, whether it was through Facebook groups or LinkedIn, and just seeking, like, if there was an interest for a platform that really tied things together, whether it was, you know, mentorship, career specific, or even just from a South Asian cultural perspective, because at the time there was like a bombardment of activism on socials, but it was all very generic things, like how not to use certain types of plastics or how to recycle. And it, although there were practical tips, it wasn't relevant to South Asian people. So it was kind of two part when South Asians for Sustainability came, you know, came together in my mind. I took it on myself, really, because I was just like, okay, if this space doesn't exist, it needs to, because all these people were coming back with positive feedback, like, yeah, we would love this space, we've been wanting to see it for a while, but, you know, it doesn't, there's nothing there. And that's when the everything was formed. So we started off with a spotlight series, quite similar to this kind of podcast layout, but speaking specifically to South Asian founders, South Asian professionals who are working in both environmental and social impact space. Getting their stories heard, getting their, you know, their career journeys out there. One, as a form of representation, but two, just as a, you know, indication to other students who are studying in the space what their jobs might look like. Because I think there was a huge amount of, like, vaulted information, not purposefully, but because that information was not accessible, people didn't even realize the kind of roles that they could apply for and what was out there for them. To kind of get involved and stuck in with. I will say this was combined at the same time where, as I mentioned, those jobs were increasing. This was the start of that journey. So there were still students who were like, oh, there's not many jobs. I don't really know what they're called. We were still moving from like CSR to sustainability and in terminology. So it was really helpful from that spotlight series perspective, which we've continued till date. But then alongside that, it was also about showing how sustainable actions and climate consciousness and knowledge could be applied to South Asian communities, whether it was through faith-based festivals, religious-based events, our weddings, our food, our fashion, you know, such colourful parts of our heritage, but really being able to connect to the community about climate change through those mechanisms. I think that was a key shift in, like, being able to bring our communities on board a bit more and deepen that relatability to the topic. So yeah, that's really how it came about, and we've just continued for the last 5 years trying to do our bit.
Yeah, and, like, I've seen the community grow so much since I started following you on Instagram like 3 years ago now. One of the things is, do you have any lessons that you can share about building communities? Because it's, we live in a time and a space where we need them. And yeah, if you have any tips on how people can do that, I think it would be very well received.
Thank you. I think adaptability is the key one, because as time changes, so do community needs. And as situations change, so do community needs. So whereas when we first started out, everything was online. Everything was, you know, accessible on webinars, and people were joining, you know, Zooms, and that was the forum then. And things, obviously we have social media, which has remained, but it's now come back to the point of people wanting in-person events, wanting to rebuild community out of kind of we're way out of lockdown times now, but I think there was still the shift, right, where like a lot of things became home working. There was like a Zoom or like online webinar fatigue that was building up, or like, so it was adaptability that allowed us to then listen to the community, what their needs are, what they'd like more of. And in the last 2 years, we've shifted our focus to doing more in-person things. So, you know, last year we did an event based in a nature walk based in the Lincolnshire coast, and really to get South Asian women out into nature. Everything was about well-being and reconnecting to nature itself. And we had some like mindful art therapy integrated, just like a nice time to be able to rebuild community in person. We're also working on like a completely different, in a different space, on South Asian personal styling, like clothing wise. So we, in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a huge uptick in our community of pre-loved, especially with like Gen Z, millennial kind of consumers. Pre-loved South Asian wear, as I mentioned, we have so many festivals, wedding season's a whole thing. Sometimes it's really pressured and it's very costly to keep up with, you know, trends, and that there's this underlying pressure. So to tackle that we've seen founders come out with rental platforms, similar to like your Vinted, but specifically for South Asian wear, or reselling. What gap has we found now from the community listening to them is personal styling in a way that reflects identity. So in corporate spaces, I remember at EY, like when we had South Asian Heritage Month, you know, I would turn up to our offices in like Modre, which are like Indian type juttis and shoes, with my like Indian earrings, chumkis on, just as a symbol of like representing culture and feeling like that represents who I am. And my, when we talk about being your full self at work, and we're hearing as well now, people want to integrate more, mix and match more with their day-to-day wear. But often those two parts of wardrobes are completely separate. Like you'll have your Asian, South Asian wardrobe and you'll have your English wardrobe. So we've put together workshops where we're actually teaching people how to bring colour more back into their wardrobe, being able to restyle some South Asian pieces, which fundamentally is more sustainable, but it also touches in on that identity part. And being able, people being able to represent their culture more in their day-to-day lives. So I think when you ask about building community, I think it's about adapting to listening to what that community needs, and being able to tie back as well, being South Asian diaspora within the UK, also being able to reconnect our communities to what's going on in South Asia. South Asia, I feel a personal responsibility towards as well. Just because there's so much happening, as I mentioned, there's still so many injustices that often, you know, don't make news headlines. And I feel SAFS is a way to reinvigorate those topics. I'm sure there's more to talk to as well, but I'll stop blabbering now.
No, you're not blabbering. I had a question. Where do you see South Asians for Sustainability heading in the next 5 to 10 years? And what would you want it to be remembered for? Like, what's the legacy you want SAFS to have?
I don't think I've thought as far as legacy. I'm just still in like definitely driving like action forward mode. But one thing that's already coming through is, you know, and it's really fulfilling for me personally. I will have students kind of reach back out, who reached out to SAFS like many years ago when they were early on in their journeys, and being like, oh, we've landed our first job and we just wanted to say thank you because we listened to this webinar, and we joined this workshop and it really helped us. And so that definitely is like the legacy piece, part of it already, but it gives me so much, selfishly, like so much fulfillment. Because it's hard to kind of do this kind of voluntary side of things, because I don't get paid for SAFS and it is, you know, self-driven. To not have some sense of check-in of where it's, how it's helping people and helping the community, it's hard to keep going and stay motivated sometimes. But when you hear those kind of stories and those tidbits, then it gives you all the energy you need to keep going. But where I see things changing, as I mentioned, I can't foresee what the future holds naturally, but what I am hearing now is just this greater sense of South Asian professionals, South Asian women particularly are really like standing out at the minute. I don't know if it's the time of year, but I've just sensed like a great passion coming through about, you know, change making and wanting to take on something that they feel very strongly about. Whether it's, you know, we're looking at social impact driven things, whether it's things like period poverty or, you know, general looking at hygiene things within South Asia, right through to mangrove building and tree planting and wanting to take forward drives. Like, it's all interconnected, right? When we look at sustainability, it's this broad umbrella of not just climate change, not just biodiversity, but everything that falls under the people and community driven impacts as well. Education is another one that's still, you know, so strong for some people. But I think it's listening into those and giving people the ability and access to take forward what they're passionate about is really where I see things shifting. It's that ripple effect. And I think being able to educate people along the way, I think a lot of people now know what they care about, but those who don't, it's still providing that platform. Okay, we have, like we've had Ramadan, I've been working with Islamic Relief on, they have an Eco Ramadan campaign right now that they've been pushing out. Same with Holi, we've just had the Festival of Holi. So looking at religious festivals, things that are year on year that continue, but reshaping people's perspectives and mindsets on how they go about those events. I think that's really going to continue building, especially the more that people realize that everything's interconnected, what they see happening in South Asia, in Global South regions, even our extremities in the UK in terms of weather and how we're seeing things change. Mm-hmm. I think people are now starting to link the dots. And I think that's where SAFs also can continue to support, like, helping people realize that that is all interconnected. But yeah, broadly speaking, that's where my brain is at. You can probably tell it's lots of different directions, but things, yeah, just remaining adaptable and listening to what people's needs are is probably
amazing. Lovely. I've got a question about your research project with the University of Nottingham. So, like, you briefly explained it to myself and Gary when we caught up with you a few weeks ago, but I think it will be really nice to hear what you're up to, how is it going, what's the objective, and yeah.
Absolutely. So it's a 3-year long research project, and it again brings me back to psychology a bit. We're working directly with the University of Nottingham's climate change psychology remit and the professors there. It's part of a global study where we're looking at how climate change impacts, if at all, the well-being of Black and South Asian communities any differently. There's a region in Canada where they're looking at Indigenous communities there, different parts of Africa, Germany, India, and the UK. So there's teams all over. We're still in kind of research mode, so still gaining insights and building up different community-based listening sessions that's coming this year to really test the theory is, you know, how is climate change impacting at all our communities here in the diaspora. But because it is a global study, it's quite exciting because we can look at themes across to see if there's similarities, what the differences are, if any. It's been a real pleasure to be part of a project that allows me to keep that psychology nerd in me, kind of that cup filled up. Even when I was working at EY and until date, eco-anxiety has been something that's I've been very aware about, something that I've tried to, you know, drive forward as a passion project and being able to provide that support. And I think it continued because I specifically remember some workshops that I ran where we were hearing from people in different parts of South America, different parts of India, and Bangladesh, you know, at the time employees from different regions, and they were sharing how climate change was really real for them. They've already been displaced once. The impact that had on their mental health, the anxieties that they deal with, you know, on a day to day, versus, you know, when we were looking at communities in Europe, or employees in Europe and the UK, it was more of a perceived threat. It's more, it's coming, we're not sure how to support our kids who are worried about it. And that stark difference again highlighted the level of the communities who've least impacted or give, you know, contributed towards climate change are currently being affected the most now. And those who necessarily haven't, you know, we're relatively well protected in the UK weather-wise, extremity-wise, and I think, yeah, it just re-highlighted that for me, and the need to support communities of in global south regions and naturally South Asia as well. So the project is going well, to sum up, but that I'm hopeful that the insights we gain from it can actually help shape shift some policy going forward, in terms of the support we can provide diaspora communities and those more globally as well.
Amazing. So I think Gary's going to ask you some questions about challenges and like barriers, future trends. So I'll pass on to Gary.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you know, sometimes, you know, climate change and impact on communities, it can sound a bit abstract, you know, a bit, you know, generic. But when you, that the, what you, and you said they've already been displaced once, you know, that really brings it alive. And it was almost sort of saying it's likely to happen again as well. And, you know, it can sometimes sound abstract, but the idea of being displaced, it's just, when you really think about that, it's horrible, isn't it? You know, like you say, in the UK, and you know, many people hopefully, you know, quite safe and protected from this kind of stuff. But yeah, the idea of that is terrifying. And but yeah, that is the experience of some people. You are an inspiration with what you're doing and what you've done with SAFS. Really, it sounds like a really wonderful thing you're creating here, from so many aspects that you've covered. So you're definitely an inspiration.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate that. I think as well, just to highlight, like, there are obviously issues within the UK. You know, we're not unaware of cost of living, and even just even like when you hear about the flooding that happens on the southern coast as well. You know, not to diminish that in any way or minimize that. But yeah, I think it's really stark when you do hear of the, I guess, the amount that this happens in South Asia and other regions in the global south. And how sadly normalized it's become. I think that's another thing, like even from an air pollution perspective, like I know my family's in India, who are relatively okay financially. You know, they have to have like air purifiers in every room of their house just to have normal breathing air. And that's something that we take so for granted because it's just the way it is, right? But when you, I do hear direct stories, whether it's extreme flooding in South Asia and Pakistan and Bangladesh and in parts of India, it does bring this really urgent matter to life a lot more, like you've said. And it goes beyond headlines, news headlines, news stories, when you're hearing from people directly, like your families and your wider communities that have been struck by extreme events. So yeah, I think just pushing that message forward as much as possible is, is the aim, and hoping that people connect to it through it.
Yeah, well, we're connecting definitely now through it, and I can see how it's just about getting your message out there more. What's the toughest challenges that you faced, either that you've overcome or that you've just, you know, not been successful with, or things that you really have not been able to achieve yet that you, you know, you really want to?
I think with, if I'm thinking of SAFS, I'm quite ambitious, but as you can probably tell, I'm quite split between all my passions. And I've tried to reframe that this year now as like I'm leading a portfolio career, or I'm like leading this portfolio life where I, by filling up my creative cup, it gives me the energy to carry on with SAFS and consulting and all the other kind of community-based work. But that is it's a challenge to find the balance, and it's only this year I've started to feel a bit more aligned. But it did mean I had to give something had to give, and that was, you know, reducing my hours a bit more at my current job, so that it allows more time for the campaigning and community work that I really want to do. So it's not necessarily the toughest challenge, but being able to accept that as a human being, you only have so much capacity to do all these things. I think that was because I earlier in my 20s, I was just like, no, I've got so much energy, I can just push. And it led to so much burnout. And I was on this cyclical path for almost 3 years where I'd have like a really intense, like productive period, so-called productivity. But then I'd crash and I'd be out for like a month. Those were the times as well when I'd see more climate change news, I would then go into this spiral of like, even mental health wise, like feeling things really deeply. And I couldn't pick myself back up. So it was kind of like, and I think a lot of young people, a lot of activists can very quickly fall into this cycle where, you know, it's a huge responsibility and a weight to carry a lot of this, to want to do better for others. But if you're not filling up your own cup and you're not like energized yourself, I think it can quickly lead to this burnout cycle. Which I've also noted, like I'm just speaking to other activists, they, you know, other community based organizations, like it's quite a common thing. So I think that's quite a common challenge that a lot of people in our space do experience. But from a more strategic perspective or a broader, I think I really want to make SAFs bigger. I want to scale it. But given the funding situations in the UK and the lack thereof, it gets very difficult to continue this work. And that's something that I'm like coming to terms with now, like how can we get better access to funding, things that actually will support this work, taking it forward and being able to reach like a much wider audience than we already have. So yeah, I think that's quite, yeah, I've touched on the mental health side and also, yeah, structurally, some things that can be quite challenging.
Yeah. So who's your audience in some ways? Who do you hope is listening and, you know, what change you, or inspiration you're hoping they find from this?
I want, without being too broad, I think intergenerationally, like parents and younger people, we have a lot in terms of our audience, we have a lot of parents actually messaging us, like we're hearing this from our kids, they're learning about this in school and coming to us and being like, how do we deal with this? We don't even know what to say. Or, you know, kids these days ask a lot of questions that people don't have the answers to. They're very curious. And I think that's a key demographic for us. And also young people, either students or just recent graduates or people trying to enter the space, people in corporate. So quite a broad spectrum, but there is something that I feel everybody can connect to, even through our collaborations with Faith to the Climate. And I mentioned, you know, the faith-based, religious base work. There are so many communities doing such great work, and that's being able to access and reach kind of our elder generations as well. You know, I often speak to my grandfather because I feel I can learn so much from his experiences. And he often recalls how so much of our culture, like as South Asians, is inherently sustainable. Things he describes from when he was growing up in India, you know, so much of that, there's so much wisdom in all of it. So reaching all these all of these kind of generations, I feel there's things to be learned and things, impact to be had in different ways. And I think when you go for culture, when you go for something like South Asian culture, you're able to reach people of all ages. A long-winded answer to your question, but I think I don't really put a finger on these are the age group or this demographic is who I'm trying to reach. I'm hoping everyone can connect to something in what we're doing.
Yeah, fabulous. And what do you see ahead, like over the next 5 to 10 years? What are you really hopeful for?
I think given the current situation we find ourselves in, geopolitically, my only hope is for like greater sense of peace and calm in the world. And I think I'd be remiss to not mention that, because if I could say, oh yeah, I really want SAFs to build and I really want outreach, but actually these are fundamental things like from a human rights perspective that just need to shift. And I know it was quite stark to see the World Economic Forum's risk report that just recently released for 2026. And to be able like to see the shift from climate-based risks shifting to like a 10-year framework, and then seeing things like inequality and, you know, misinformation and all of these kind of risks that you didn't think would ever be as high on the agenda becoming like in the next 2 years, these are the biggest global risks. It feels like, well, what have we done wrong in society to just be back in this place? It feels like, yeah, quite dystopian, to be honest. So my hope is for all of this to sort itself out ASAP. And then being able to empower people to be change makers and that ripple effect that I was mentioning earlier. That is my sincere hope. Like, whatever we do in SAF, someone can take something away from it and really action it in their day-to-day life, whether it's their career or their passion work, or just connecting people to what they feel is their calling. And ideally it'd be from a sustainability climate perspective. That would be amazing.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. And more peace. I completely agree with that one. Is there anything that we've not talked about that's a theme you think needs more attention?
Great question. I think I've been to a lot of different panels, events, and often it's kind of a spoken thing, but I've not seen it in action. I personally feel in Global South regions across the world, people who are already dealing with like being displaced once, there's an inherent wisdom and solution focused mentality that they have. But whether or not those voices and that message from a community angle is reaching policymakers, funders, is a different thing. For example, when we think of solutions to tackle and build resilience in regions of South Asia, you know, often it's like funds being like, oh, we've got this pot of money, let's channel it to the government and then they can sort out how that money's used. But when you listen to community voices on the ground, it's very different, the solutions, what they need, what would make a difference to their lives. And it's just not, it's not reaching where that money can go. I think a lot of it does come down to financing, but people thinking they know better and then applying that fund in a way that is actually not as useful and helpful. I think there needs to be a much greater sense of listening and taking on board what those solutions are from people who have unfortunately had to deal with shit already. what is the actually need for those people? How can we make sure the funds actually reach them and for the things that they actually need that are going to help them build resilience? I think that's something that is still goes very, you know, you hear about massive budgets being signed off or not massive budgets being signed off or not big enough, but that money often doesn't reach the people and communities that need it the most or in the way that they need it most. So that's one thing that I think is still untapped.
Yeah, that brings me on to my last question, really, which is something I've touched on in some previous episodes and so on. I'm really interested in what you think of it. But in some ways, I think like sustainability has an image problem or a brand problem or the word, like, you know, and there's been a shift, obviously. It certainly seems, you know, probably less in vogue, not that that's the right way of looking at it, but sustainability, it feels like, you know, it doesn't feel like a sense of growth or gain. It feels like a sense of what we're trading, what we're not having, like net zero feels like, you know, compromise and so on. And somehow, even more so these days with certain shifts, but it just feels like it obviously hasn't having a lot of success and a lot of, you know, lots of positive things, but somehow the words or the language or something around it is clearly not landing as much at the moment. Hopefully it comes back through, but what do you, you know, taking stock, see that maybe is wrong or a way that can be reframed that really starts to land more?
It's a really, really relevant question because I've seen it with so many clients already. This, the politicization of some words and you're just like, how is this even a thing? But it is unfortunately a thing. What I've seen work so far is outcome driven. So if, for example, if I take diversity, equity, inclusion, some companies are now steering away from that terminology. I never thought I'd say that, but yeah. it's about shifting it into framing it as, what's the outcome? You want to build better fairness for employees. You want to, it's I think that's the shift. And when we're thinking about language, it's about looking at what's the outcome. You want to build a healthier workforce. You want to reduce your retention, like you want to increase your retention. And I think shifting it to more, at least in a business corporate perspective, shifting that language to something that's more outcome focused rather than the actual word itself, that has become like almost a trigger point or a triggering word for some people. I think that's how we still maintain focus on the end goal and can still get to where we want to get to. I think it's about adapting language to whichever audience or community or person we're speaking to, in a way that they can connect to the most. And I think that takes a bit more of a broader perspective.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because there's the word sustainability. Maybe there's some kind of loaded terms in some respects, but if you said to someone, would you like cleaner air?
Yeah.
Would you like clean water? Yeah. Would you like less pollution? I think nearly everyone likes the idea of those outcomes. Absolutely. I think, and it's probably that you need to focus on more.
Yeah,
love that. Thank you so much, Fibs.
No, thank you,
Michelle. I think you had some final.
It is my favorite round.
Was that? Yeah.
My favorite round, which is the quickfire round. So I'm going to ask you a series of rapid fire questions. Just tell us the first thing that comes into your mind. Okay. What's one book or podcast that's currently on your list or that you're reading that you'd recommend?
A Really Good Cry by Radhi Shetty. It's a podcast. It's not a book. I'm not really a book reader. I'm definitely audio person. I think so. She has like different people on. I learn a lot from it. She talks a lot about what it means to be a female and like empower. Like, you know, there's a lot of stigma that comes with crying for both genders. For I don't know why, but looking at life in a different perspective is very growth mindset driven, but particularly empowering for females. Using like our cycles to our advantage, using our energy in a different way, and just rewriting the rules a bit.
Nice, you've influenced me. One habit that keeps you motivated?
Music. And naturally, and I did an energy healing course, something that's been on my list for a long time to do back in September. Since then, I have meditated every single morning and it has changed my life. And I don't say that lightly. Like, I feel I wake up so much more focused, aligned, intentional, and just able to breathe through things better. It sounds silly, but I think forget to breathe sometimes, or like it becomes so shallow and then you don't realize how much that impacts how you feel. So yeah.
Okay, nice one. This one is intentionally ambiguous. What's your biggest mistake and subsequent learning?
Oh god. I don't know if it's a mistake. I feel like I believe everything works out as it's meant to and in the right timing, but I wish I went part-time sooner with my job and in my career, because it's allowed space for me to focus in on things that give me equal amount of pleasure and fulfillment and being able to focus on SAFs.
Amazing. What's a quote or motto that you live by?
I'm a big believer in the law of attraction, so I don't think it's a quote, but believing, even from a neuroscience perspective, like setting your intention, visualizing the outcome of anything that you'd like to happen in your life, to be of service, all those things are things I visualize and manifest in a way. So I believe there's a bigger energy doing all of it.
Nice one. So if you weren't working in sustainability, what else would you be working in?
Well, I also work in music at the same time already.
And not music, I guess?
Interior design. I love designing things and architecture and all of that jazz.
Amazing. Okay, this one is really ambiguous, and I don't think this one was intentional, but what's one prediction for 2030 that you have? And I guess that could be personally, professionally, SAFs related?
I have no idea. 2030 is 4 years away. Personally, I hope I have a house by then. I don't know, like, I haven't thought, I'm like very much, I used to be a 5-year planner person, now I'm just like, okay, take a day at a time and like think about the month ahead. But yeah, hopefully, personally, I have a house by then. It's a really, yeah, SAFs, I don't, yeah, I'm just going to keep going with what I'm hearing and hearing from people what they want.
Nice. Okay, and last question is, what's your favorite SDG and why?
Reduce inequalities. I don't know what number that is, but yeah, ties into everything we've spoken about today. That was a really hard rapid fire.
Talk about my favorite for a reason.
Thank you.
Vibs, thank you so much. I'm so glad to have met you. Really, and Michelle, thank you so much for the introduction. We've had a couple of conversations previously. You know, love talking to you immediately. I've really loved this conversation. It is inspirational. I'm definitely going to look more into SAFs, particularly some of the events that you have, like some of the music ones as well would really appeal to me. So if people want to follow, find out more, where would they go? We'll have to put the links in the notes.
Yes. So on LinkedIn and Instagram, Vibhati Bhatia or South Asians for Sustainability. For my music, it's Vibs Bhatia on Instagram. But yeah, or SouthAsiansForSustainability.com is where you can find SAFs related work.
Wonderful. We'll make sure to share that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much again. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure has been all mine. Thank you so much, both. It's been a really interesting conversation. And yeah, I hope there's something that someone can take from the conversation. And if you'd like to get involved, volunteer in any way for SAFs or run your own events, like, I'm all ears and always open to a conversation. So please do reach out.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Moved. If this has sparked something for you, subscribe and share it with someone who's looking to make a difference. I'm Michelle Noor.
And I'm Gary Watts. And we'll see you next time as we explore what moves people and ideas forward.